Hi, I'm Diane Gregg, and welcome to Invisible Women, a podcast about eight women who worked in espionage during World War II. They were from different countries, cultures, and backgrounds. What they had in common was the opportunity to step outside of societal norms, while at the same time working in the shadows. And while their contributions were incredibly important, they've been hidden. Invisible Women is an opportunity to hear their stories, to explore their roles in society, and to discover what we can learn from these stories that's relevant today.
SOE leader in France specifically requested a woman agent because it would be easier for him to maneuver around if he was with a woman. At checkpoints set up by the Germans, a woman could smile and bat her eyes and they would let them through. The women were less suspect.
That's Céline, a young woman who was parachuted into France as a courier for the British Special Operations Executive, the SOE, about a week before D-Day. In establishing the SOE in 1940, the British High Command communications suggests that they wanted to choose women who were attractive, charismatic, but not too threatening, and ones that could use their female attributes strategically to flirt and seduce men, such as batting their eyes and engaging the enemy in pillow talk. The general consensus was that women could use their seductive characteristics and be less suspect. And also, it was remarked that women were good at data organization and record keeping, which would be useful. These early communications reveal the gender bias against women and the stereotypic beliefs, not unlike the propaganda of the era, as I discussed in a previous episode. Also, the threat that women would gain the trust of men in private places in order to undo them was part of the era's cultural narrative about women. In addition, the SOE command felt that the Nazis had very restrictive views about women, and therefore the women's roles in espionage would pass undetected through the Nazi checkpoints, and women would operate more openly and easily than men. The women were selected and trained the same as their male counterparts, except in training, they were also up against instructors' biases and received some of the harshest treatment, as Céline discusses in this episode. Even though the SOE women proved themselves equal and more compared to the male agents, the underlying perception that they were not as well-equipped or astute remained unchanged through the war. Yet these SOE women who knew the foreign territory and could speak the language were sent in to perform some of the most dangerous tasks, like couriering and wireless operating. As I've discussed in previous episodes of Invisible Women, the bipolar stereotype of women as the virginal nun versus the vamp has run through Western culture since the splitting of the fuller feminine archetypal continuum and characteristics thousands of years ago. The wholeness and the integrity of people's deep connection with the earth, seasons, and life purpose was reflected in an all-encompassing goddess, a living gestalt of their lives, not unlike the concept of Gaia today. However, for them, it was not just a concept. Or when the Black Madonna was venerated in the 12th century. This kind of worship was the embodiment of something greater, mysterious, ethereal, deeply interconnecting and soul-making. It was the connection with the timeless cyclic ribbons which run through our collective history, humanity, and our individual lives, repeated through ritual and storytelling about our interconnected place in the cosmos and in the mystery of life. This was a grounded, empowering identity for all, founded in elegance, integrity, and meaningfulness. Besides examining Western cultural history, we can also look cross-culturally for representations of cultural, sanctioned embodiment. For instance, we can witness the daily and very embodied spirituality in Lhasa, the capital city of Tibet, as the Buddhist people circumnavigate the town center, reciting prayers and twirling their prayer wheels. And in Yangon, Myanmar, at the 170-meter high Golden Pagoda, where families, including young children, gather in the evenings and engage in various interactive rituals with many statues, including washing them, arranging flowers, lighting candles, and generally sitting in the moonlight, talking about their day at the foot of the pagoda. In many places in the world, people embody their spirituality and other aspects of their daily life. Returning to Western culture, and after the 12th century, the disconnection with nature, the cosmos, and our embodiment became further severed when the Black Plague decimated societies in the mid-1300s. Over the next centuries, an irrational fear of the body caused a fault line to be drawn between nature, the body, women, and the rational perspective of society. Western mathematical reductionism took firm root alongside the religious pathos of the day. Mankind became the controller over nature, and the feminine, mysterious, empowering principle, along with respect for the sacredness of the body and the earth, went further underground, relegated to what was called the irrational. The need for control and power by the dominating society created an even more truncated and eclipsed reality for women. Women's empowerment was even more corseted, and women, their bodies, and the earth were further objectified and scapegoated upon. During this time, societal projections fueled the witch burnings of women and others on the fringes of society. A Holocaust which spanned three centuries, from the 1400s to the 1700s. Women and vulnerable others who had a connection with the creative, the mystery, with indigenous traditions, were sacrificed for the greater good. So with the success of literally burning away indigenous knowledge and feminine ways of being, women were completely cut off from their empowerment. Her story, including women's rites of passage, healing rituals, and the wealth of traditional ways which were passed from mothers to daughters over centuries, were lost. And these losses are still reflected in society today. The devastation brought by the witch hunts meant that silence and sacrifice of women and others to authoritarian rule increased. To keep themselves and their children safe, women learned quickly how to be silent and repress their varied and natural ways of being, as they were subjugated and denied on the top side of their lives. The power of the Black Madonna also transmuted further, reflecting what was occurring in society. She was last seen as the very powerful nature goddess within Mary in Leonardo da Vinci's work in the 15th century. Coming back to World War II, women in the workforce was treated as an aberration, something that was only temporary. But the World War II women I interviewed who were selected and agreed to tasks behind the lines said they felt exhilarated and thrilled by the work. These courageous, intuitive, discerning, resilient, adventuresome risk takers wanted to carry out action-oriented, strategic, and creative tasks. The sanctioned espionage activities gave them freedom to be who they were, to express themselves in ways not previously allowed within society. This was empowering as they began embodying capabilities they had not fully previously tapped into. They were pulling from the fuller human spectrum of characteristics and expressing these personal proclivities, greater vitality and aliveness was felt. So during this specified time, these women were given permission to express themselves outside the usual traditional box, which invited a deep sense of freedom, even in the midst of occupied territories. They functioned from a grounded, embodied place of being congruent with a truer identity of themselves. One dominant cultural way of being, that is a linear, rational, reductionistic society like ours, like Western culture, is not enough in and of itself to solve the problems it creates, for instance, the ecological crisis. We need to honor different worldviews, ways of being, and the varied creativity within these societies and individuals. along with projections, repression, and the fear of anything other, has been the overall subjugation of the imaginal and creative possibilities. There has actually been a war against different creative expressions due to the fear of losing power and control by the dominant culture. And of course, this repression has affected us all. Returning to the women in espionage who felt enlivened and empowered, their greater self-agency, for the most part, ended abruptly with the war. Post-war, their heroic accomplishments were not celebrated or honored, but rather they were conscripted into bipolar categories. The split of the feminine continuum and the eclipsing of their contributions through stereotypes became obvious as women agents were called spy martyrs. That is, they sacrificed themselves, or bad women, collaborators who had sex with the enemy. In addition, Allied propaganda encouraged women to return to the hearth, to the home, and political controls were put in place for them to do so. As this took place, there were also harsh reminders, regardless of what the women had accomplished, to stay in their traditional lanes. Not unlike the witch hunts, women were rounded up. This time, they were branded. As towns throughout Europe were liberated, young men who had not gone to war began strong-arming women into groups and shaving their heads in public town squares, symbolizing the decapitation of female embodiment and the empowerment that went with it. These women, resistors, agents, officers, were punished for being collaborators, even though they had been asked by the military or resistance cells or even their families to befriend the Germans for information or food or favors. But all of a sudden, their acts of bravery and sacrifice were turned. They became the whore, the vamp, because their actions were dangerous to the status quo now. The collective viewed women's aliveness, vitality, and sexual freedom as dangerous and suspect to the tapestry of the nation, to the status quo, even though much of this was a projection on the part of the establishment. I'm often asked how and why did the women interviewees remain silent about their war lives even after the Official Secrets Act was lifted, and also with their families. Although trauma may play a part in staying silent for someone, for women compared to men, it was more complicated. Some women agents were fearful of talking about their contributions, even with their husbands and families, because the shame inherent in the role constructed by European and North American societies around their contributions. The projections as a collaborator or prostitute kept them from discussing their war service. The lack of medals, validation, and celebration caused more shame, humiliation, and trauma as the years went by. Even in the interviews I conducted, while these women were in their late 70s to 90s, some still devalued their contributions. Their self-agency, empowerment, exhilaration, feelings of contributions were undone post-war in a variety of ways. So not only were the women living with the horrors of war, what they had witnessed and what happened to them, they also couldn't revisit the good aspects, their accomplishments, and the exhilaration and thrilling parts of being agents, being free of cultural norms, finding greater self-agency, independence, and the freeing aspects inherent in the espionage work. It was all darkened for them and left in the shadow of their lives. Therefore, during the war and afterwards, these women's counter-narratives to authoritarian culture could not flourish, and the stereotypes and endarkenment continued. The ordinary woman who had stepped up to the plate with bravery was shut down post-war. And in such a milieu, why would you ever tell your espionage story, even after the Official Secrets Act was up, if you felt someone might shame you for your selfless acts of bravery? Unless, in the last stages of your life, a woman researcher asks you to reveal your story anonymously. In the summer of 2005, and with the winds from Hurricane Katrina moving through eastern Canada, I drove to Celine's condo. Since electricity was already out in other suburbs, I decided to walk up the 3 flights of stairs to her apartment, rather than chance having our time together slip away because of an elevator stoppage. As I knocked on the teal-painted door decorated with silk flowers, I heard her dog barking on the other side, and then soon, her voice to quietly reassure her. She opened the door, flashed a smile, inviting me in, while her small white poodle wagged its fluffy body. Cold and somewhat wet, I really appreciated the dark coffee she served. We sat in her living area, engulfed in light teal walls of her well-appointed flat, drinking out of blue and white French teacups. We sat and chatted about her World War II work and other SOE women and men agents. I found her polite, gracious, and a good conversationalist. I enjoyed my time with her very much, especially her quick wit and how she shifted in depth with the questions. As we talked about the serious issues, her dark brown eyes were direct and focused.
I was in France. My parents had separated when I was very young. My father went to South Africa, and my mother took my brother and I to the south of France.
Il me semble que ce matin le soleil est un peu moins brillant. Serait-ce la fin des vacances, la fin de l'insouciance? Il me semble que ce matin le soleil peine à colorer le ciel. Voudrais prolonger les vacances, partir en convalescence.
When war broke out, it felt like freedom because I could leave. Mother was away visiting, and I decided to go live with my grandparents in England. I made my way there with no money or passport. I can't remember how I did that. I finished high school in Britain. When I graduated, I got a job in a convalescent home for pilots in southern England who had been shut down. I was 16. I wanted to do more, but would not lie about my age, so the summer I was 17, I applied for the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, the WAF. I knew that if I didn't volunteer, I would get called up anyway and perhaps do something I didn't want. I got my notice and went and reported for basic training. We were billeted up in the north of London in individual houses. I don't know why, but for some reason they put me in charge. Yet some girls were older than me. I had more life experiences, I guess. Unfortunately, we had 2 attempted suicides, and I was in charge. Didn't know what to do, really. Panicked a bit at first. Then took them to the hospital to have their stomachs pumped. With one girl, they said, "You have to take her back." So I stayed up and walked her all night long, and she came through. But the other one didn't. The girls came from all walks of life, and many hadn't enlisted voluntarily. Basic training was tough. Some couldn't take it. Some went to the red light district in London and made more money on their feet than in the WAF. We called them the Piccadilly Commandos. I had another friend. She was a dental assistant. Very tall and slender. She got pregnant by a senior officer, a married man. We hated him. Took our side, of course. You couldn't tell she was pregnant. But one day she fainted in front of a sergeant, and then after that, she wasn't pregnant. She apparently went to the toilet, had the baby in the toilet, and strangled it. I don't know how she could have done it. There was an inquiry, but apparently, in those days, a woman is not responsible for her actions 48 hours after the delivery. This is what we were told. And when I think about this today, no blame was laid on her, but she changed, as she could not live with what she'd done. The officer was a pilot. He took them up in his plane, a fighter plane, and crashed it. Of course, he felt guilty too. How did they tell his wife afterwards? I don't know. So many lives ruined unnecessarily because of cultural restraints. There are many very sad stories of what happened to people in the war. I spent 2 years in the WAF, but I was completely bilingual and bored to tears doing administrative work there. I asked my father if he could get me a job with the Free French. I was in the Midlands, at a station with another girl who spoke fluent French from Belgium, and we were with the Free French guys. My father was in the RAF, and I asked him to pull some strings. My girlfriend was called up to London. 2 months went by, and I was not. So the next time I got a 48-hour pass, I went home to my father's house. I asked him, how come they pulled her, not me? He told me maybe I wasn't qualified, maybe too young. I thought that was a funny reaction. So I said, if you don't do anything about it, I'm going to. And I was called down to London within a couple of days. I did not know what I was getting into. None of us did. In London, I was interviewed by several people. One interviewed me in French, which always makes me laugh. The person who gave me my French test was an American army officer who could not speak French at all. After a day of interviews, I was told to go back to my base and we'll call you. I wandered around London a bit and then met Dad at the train to return home with him. He started pumping me with questions about my day, and I had been told not to say anything to anybody. I said I went window shopping because that's what we did in those days. We didn't have any coupons or money. And then he asked, did you see so-and-so and so-and-so? And I said, how did you know? Well, it turned out he was on the board who picked the women to go into the SOE from the WAF and had some say on who was dropped behind the lines. He was one of the RAF group captains. He had concerns about me going into enemy territory. I made it clear to him that it was my decision and that I wanted to go. He said, well, we'll see what happens. You probably won't pass the training course and the war will be over before you finish your training. Ha! But I did pass. And the war was not over. The first attribute they wanted was someone who spoke French perfectly. And second, those who knew the country. I was 19, the youngest. It lasted for a good 3 months. I am a daredevil. I wasn't afraid, and I was dying to get back to France. Also, I was very security conscious. You had to be. It was your skin and everyone else's. There were some that were not cautious. For instance, they would send us chocolate bars on the parachute drops. And one day, I was with this guy in France, and he pulled out a chocolate bar with the English wrapping on it. Oh my God, I nearly had a fit. He was at least 10 years older than me, and oh my God, yes, it was a big risk. I refused to work with him again. And you know, he was captured not long after we landed. Another thing, I could keep my mouth shut and forget. I was told to forget everything we had done and all names. just to remember only the things we had to use at that point and time. Put the training behind you, they would say. They were terrified what people under torture would say. I practiced forgetting. I pushed things way back in my mind. At first, we were sent up to an estate in the remote Scottish Highlands, then to Beaulieu Estate in New Forest, to the SOE finishing school. We all learned personal security, how to detect when you are being followed, how to lose someone, how to endure interrogation and to hold out for 48 hours so others could get away. In Scotland, we were all trained in reading maps, how to use weapons, knives, guns of all kinds from various countries, especially German ones, which many resistance cell members had captured behind enemy lines. I liked explosives and was trained in sabotage. It was fun. We learned how to make them from household ingredients, how to place charges to blow up a rail line or bridge, how to detonate and set timers. One day, after the final instruction, another agent and I in training took the leftover explosives and set what we thought would be a small explosion near the outside wall of a lodge where another friend slept. And then at night, set it off. The glass blew out of all of the windows in that part of the building. Since it was the war, there was no replacement glass available. The windows had to be boarded up. We were talked to about that. We were taught how to drive a steam engine, but funny, I couldn't even drive a car yet. I had terrible shooting skills. I was a two-handed shooter, and I had to buy the drink rounds because I would lose. I injured my back when we were doing the commando training, doing rope training. One of the obstacles we had to do was marked 50 points. Thought I'd do that one, as I am good at trees. Climbed the tree up 50 feet, then grabbed the rope and asked the sergeant with a clipboard below, "How do I do this?" And I was holding on with my hands only, and he said, "Just come down or something." He should have said, "Use your legs," but didn't. I fell flat on my back. I felt that he willingly didn't tell me to use my legs. I woke up in the hospital knowing that he purposely didn't tell me to use my legs. It was only a little crack, but it was recorded. I was soon back in training. The SOE brought in an expert safe cracker out of prison to teach us. After learning his techniques and how to open a locked room with a hairpin, I decided that I'd like to crack the lodge's safe and look at my personal file. Another female agent and I decided one night to read our reports, and we did get into that safe. The next morning, we went to the commanding officer and told him what we had done. He wouldn't have known otherwise. He was not pleased with it. I told him that I disputed the accuracy of one of my instructor's reports. I had been frustrated with some of the instructors. Although, a few were very nice to look at. The training instructor had written something about me that was not fair. You know, some of the younger instructors who were not potential agents were difficult and jealous of the agents in training, and especially hard on the women. We were trained the same, but the treatment and the scoring was different at times, and this was reflected in my file. I loved the training. Every moment of it. I was 19 and a born tomboy. I was free and easy and away from home. I was doing what I wanted and having fun. I was thoroughly enjoying it. The head guy in charge took me to lunch one day, said, "Several people, including some instructors, think we shouldn't use you, send you into France. And I looked up at him and said, why not? Well, they think you are too much of a teenager. I said, that is nonsense after the upbringing I've had in France. Left my home and my mother at 15. I've been doing things for myself for a long time. If I've been playing the fool, it's just that I've been enjoying myself. So he said, I know you can look more sophisticated because you have been brought up in France. You don't look like a British schoolgirl, so I want you to act older. And I said, no problem at all. So I completed my training and they sent me in. I wasn't afraid. I was very security conscious and I'm very adaptable. My husband and I met while we were in Scotland in SOE training. We were paired for the explosive training. He was a Canadian paratrooper, had previously trained at Camp X near Ottawa. After a few weeks, we were inseparable and decided to get married. After training, but before we dropped into France. So, we did. In London, in 1944, with a reception at the RAF Club in Piccadilly. SOE was not happy. They were upset because we had already been briefed about going into France together as a team. But now, it was not allowed. Once married, they split us up because they thought the Germans could use us against one another if caught. We said goodbye, not knowing if we'd ever see each other again. My husband flew in a month before me. I knew where he was during his stint behind the lines, but he didn't know where I was. All male agents received wings for parachute training completion, but not the women agents. He wore his on his uniform. But although trained the same, I wasn't even given any because women were not supposed to be trained for frontline war duties in England. But a friend embroidered wings for me, and I wore them on my uniform. After that, I went to London, to the hostel on Weymouth Street, used by the SOE French section agents waiting for their missions. I was called up with two other agents, 10 days before D-Day. A SOE leader in France specifically requested a woman agent because it would be easier for him to maneuver around if he was with a woman. You know, a checkpoint set up by the Germans. A woman could smile and bat her eyes and they would let them through. The women were less suspect. We knew the risks we were taking. We knew there was infiltration of the SOE on the ground in France. A double agent in their ranks was turning SOE agents into the Gestapo almost upon their landing in France. A lot of women went in as radio operators. They didn't suspect at first, but as the war went on, the Germans knew that women were being used undercover by the Allied forces. I was waiting near the airfield to be called, waiting for a large enough moon and good weather to do the drop. I was called and picked up to go to the airfield. It was in late May. There I received my documents, changed into the clothes. We all wore the standard issue overalls on top and received our pills, one to keep you awake for 48 hours and the other to kill you straight away, cyanide. And I flushed them both down the john as soon as I could in France, because knowing me, I'd take the wrong one at the wrong time. I'd get them mixed up. Better to rely on my own wits. I was scared stiff of heights, but the SOE never knew. I tried to do as few jumps as possible in training. You know, they told us that we'd go by submarine or aircraft. And I said I wanted to go by air. There was no way I wanted to be in a sub. I flew in with two male agents. One of them was so obviously frightened. He was shaking and staring at the red light, waiting for it to turn green and getting more and more scared by the second. He was supposed to jump first. I told the pilot to tell him I was going first. I knew that if he didn't go, it would be harder for me to jump. We saw the flashlights of our landing party in the field directing the drop. I was the first out. The moon was full, but it seemed completely dark to me as we were low, only 500 feet. Makes for a hard landing. The ground came up fast and I landed in a ditch. I didn't do a very good landing. Resistance members met us in the field and we rolled up the parachutes. We buried the chutes. You couldn't take them with you in case the French women made dresses from them. The silk was very fine. I was scared, naturally, but thrilled to be back on French soil. We searched for the containers that were dropped with us. One had my haute couture clothes in it for my cover. We couldn't locate them. They had drifted too far away. Our landing party took us to the local safe farmhouse for the night. I was bruised, hurt my shoulder, and had a very sore abdomen. Glad for the glass of local apple brandy. Since the clothes lost were ones I would have used for my cover, it was a problem. My cover story was I was in the couture business, from Paris, visiting the area to recover from bronchitis. There was concern because we knew if the Germans picked up the container, they would know right away that a woman had been dropped. Within a couple of days, we saw our containers go by on a German truck and thought, one must be my clothes, but then in a couple of weeks, I saw a French woman wearing one of my dresses. And rather than hide me on a farm like someone suggested, they decided I was to blend in like other women my age, just work away and do what I was supposed to. Logically, I would be hidden, but I was not hidden. Within 2 days, we cycled to our base, a nearby chateau about 15 kilometers away. But it was so hot, and I was still in my wool clothes. Ugh. Our cell leader found clothes for me through a retailer in town who was helping in the resistance. In Le Mans, there was a large German garrison. One thing I found difficult was seeing them marching in the streets. Anyhow, the black market restaurants were busy, and I would go in for a coffee or lunch. And often when you went in a restaurant, there was not a table. I would sit down and eat with the Germans. I would often be seen with them, and a lot of French collaborators thought I was German. Others thought I was a girlfriend of one of them. Turned out to be a good cover. But one time, I was seated beside a German officer who turned out to be the head of a local Gestapo. I had a meal, chatted with him, and when I got up to leave, I dropped my handbag. The Germans were always polite in these situations. If he had found the Colt 45 in my handbag, it would be highly suspicious. It was heavy. What would I say? I have a ton of bricks in there? But luckily, I picked it up before he did. There were several close calls like that, but you know, those were the times we lived under. The cell leader and I worked out of a small house, and we met up with the other agent near the chateau. Although I was trained in sabotage, I went in as a courier and liaison among the cells. We were there to organize them, to train the resistance groups how to maneuver, to teach them about certain weapons and explosives. We had 30 men in the woods, a marquee, a band of armed men. So we decided to split all our guys up in different farms. Security became paramount. So Even my SOE leader did not know where all the groups were hidden. It was need to know only. Before D-Day, they were told to sabotage and were very successful at disrupting telephone lines and telegraph communication among the Germans, which obliged the Germans to use the radio. At the time, I did not know about Bletchley Park's secret work and that the German radio codes had been cracked. Through the radio, the Allies were able to track German troop plans and movements, supplies and more. They couldn't do that if the Nazis used the telephone lines. Also, I would contact men who could be useful to us. I was distributing weapons which were dropped in monthly and demonstrating to this new group how to use them properly. To deliver messages between groups, I could get around on a bike. I did a lot of bicycling, averaging about 70 kilometers per day. But I used a farmer's truck to transport guns, covering them with hay. Sometimes I would be armed and hide under the hay with the rifles, and the other agent would drive the truck. But I had lost a lot of weight. When I jumped, I landed so hard that something happened to my innards. Bled often on and off the whole time I was there. I had surgery a few years later for it, but didn't receive a pension for that war injury. We didn't talk about those things. I kept my wits about me. I had a lucky star. And also, I do believe that there was the question of caution, of security. Some took unnecessary risks. I didn't. And I too think there is a sixth sense that women have that men don't have. In France, I had a couple incidents that strengthened my feeling about that. For instance, the whole resistance group would meet at the home of a Scottish woman whose French husband was away at university teaching. His wife kept the house, and she was very happy I could speak English. Three of their sons were in the resistance group. There was also a German female officer living with them because the Scottish woman was considered Aryan. We had to be careful planning our meetings. We never had them when the female officer was there. When we planned a meeting, we would fix an alternative meeting for 2 or 3 hours later, in case anything happened. One day, I was headed for their house. I was on my bike, and I just turned down their street. And I thought, this isn't right. There's something that doesn't feel right about this. And I turned around. I waited and went to the other meeting place. The guys were there when I walked in, and they were really surprised to see me. The Gestapo was watching the Scottish woman's house and raided it. They hadn't been able to get word to me because I was coming from another location. They got away because a friend of theirs who worked with the French police had managed to notify the family, and they had 15 minutes to get out. And they knew I hadn't appeared and that the Gestapo was waiting for me specifically. It was just a gut feeling. I don't think men have that. Most of the time, it's with you. And I think you can explain why you do certain things and not others. You feel good about doing them. You feel right. And turn away from others automatically when need be. On D-Day, I awoke to the sound of explosives. Allied forces targeting the nearby rail station. The team leader left for a rendezvous at the chateau. I went out to a local cafe. The radio was playing, and I heard that the landing had begun on the beaches of Normandy. I was surprised, as it was sooner than we thought. We were soon ordered to sabotage roads, telephone lines, and railway stations, but we had already done that in our area. In the next few weeks, we carried out numerous missions, making strikes mainly on German telephone lines and cables as they were repaired. We thought the advance by the Allies would be quicker than it was. At one point, the Germans invaded the forest, killing many resistance members. By the end of July 1944, we heard that the Allies had broken through the Normandy front, and we knew already from the stream of disorganized German troops coming toward us. The Germans evacuated the town shortly afterward, taking about 50 resistance prisoners with them, but leaving others behind. That was early August. I went into town and was walking by the local hairdresser, and she said, "Come in, I've got shampoo," which was a luxury because we didn't have any shampoo. We had this horrible soap and we would wash our hair sometimes in a river. So I went in and had my hair cut and I came out feeling great. It was a sunny day and the Germans were gone. But there were some local French guys who had been collaborators. I was tall, blonde, and had this reputation of being with the German officers in restaurants. That is, I had the reputation of being a French woman who went with the Germans. And these guys come up, one on either side, tied my hands behind my back, and pulled me into a truck. They took me over to the square and were marching me toward it. They were making jokes that I just had my hair done and they were going to shave my head, tie me to the lamppost. I saw the cafe where our guys would go and I yelled and saw three or four heads turn. They were there, ran over, picked me up, got me out of there. It was close. We were supposed to go back to England because General de Gaulle sent out a message to our foreign agents on French soil that they were to leave and head back to our own country. But the Americans had come through and we decided to report to one of their colonels asking if we could be of service. We knew the area very well and the positions of the Germans around, so we offered to go in for him. We did a few missions, crossing into German-held territory, getting info as to German troop movements, reporting back to the American army. The team leader and I went in as a couple who were German collaborators. It was about the third week of August, and the American army were closing in on what was called the Falaise Pocket. And their division intelligence was wanting to know if the Germans were evacuating men and equipment out of the area. Our mission was to find out. We were given new false identification papers, two sets to identify us as either American or French. We had a car and petrol authorized by the Americans, and if we were going to an area occupied by the Germans, we would use our French papers. The problem was, there were many skirmishes. One time, we crossed into an area that had been liberated by the Americans but had been retaken by the Germans and we didn't know. And we already had the Free French American flag flying on the car. And I had already switched to the American papers because I always carried the documents, our phony IDs and such. I wore a girdle and it had a pouch. The documents on my stomach. It was too late. We saw this patrol at the bridge, and all we could do was step on the gas and ride right through it. They were shooting at us. Jack got it in the shoulder, but not too deep. My jacket was in the back window, and it was riddled with holes. I wish I kept it. We ditched the car and took to the woods running. I was glad for my gun. We shot our way out as we ran. Finally, we were able to settle down to walking until we were called to a halt. As it turned out, not far along, there were German troops in the woods. We told them we were trying to flee from the Free French because we were collaborators. We'd agreed on our story before being caught. For safety, when we left the car, we broke up into two groups. They didn't know what to do with us. They held us for a while, and then the Germans got orders to move on. They didn't want the hassle of taking us with them. I don't think they believed our story completely, but they let us go. We went into this little French town, which we had been in 3 or 4 days before. It was all shut down, and it was dead. And we went into this cafe upstairs, and we were leaning out the window, which we should not have been doing. That was a big mistake. There was German patrol going by, and they called us down, took us off to a schoolyard. Nearly all men in the yard. They were holding them hostage in order to make a deal with the Americans and French. Jack had to stay as hostage, but they let me go into the town to find accommodation with a French family. Jack had forgotten his jacket at the cafe, so I said I'd go back and get it, bring it to him. The evening was chilly. I was walking through this town, and everything was shut down. All the shutters were closed. It was dusk. And I turned the corner and immediately heard footsteps just ahead. 2 German patrol were talking and walking toward me. I had to keep on walking and hoped they would pass me, but they didn't. I knew what I was in for, and had to keep my wits about me, had all the ID papers on me. I was ready to kick them and fight and thought, I can't do this because they will knock me out with the butt of their rifle. Then they will strip me and find the documents for us all. So, one held me down. You know. If they had found the papers, they would have shot the 4 of us. I was left on the ground shaking. I walked back with Jack's jacket, told him what happened. He was talking to the man next to him, who was the headmaster of the local school, and he wrote down the address of his fiancée and said, go there. I thought, I'll never find this place. It's dark. I'm afraid to go out on the streets again. Well, I bloody had to go. He said, bang loudly as they are all down in the cellar. That's what the French did. They hid their women in the cellar at night. After banging for, I don't know how long, someone came. And they weren't sure they could trust me, but they recognized his handwriting. I stayed there all night, just sitting on the cellar floor, shaking. I shook for 24 hours. The Germans released the hostages as they negotiated an agreement with the Americans. Jack and the headmaster came, and Jack and I left the town, trying to make our way back to the American lines on foot. We had to use the French papers again at another German checkpoint as we left the area. I had them, of course. That night we stayed in a French farmhouse. We looked terrible, like refugees. The next day, we decided to cross the Seine. And then an American army jeep passed us and asked who we were. We showed him our army passes and he took us to HQ. Jack's shoulder was attended to. They asked me what was wrong, I told them. The army doc checked me over. I was afraid I had picked up some disease and wanted a pregnancy test. He said, "No, you're all right." I think he just said that. It has haunted me since. I've been able to put it out in my mind, but it is there, in an unpleasant way. The memory only returns now if I see something that reminds me of Germany. I was in France a few years back, in Paris. I bent down to tie my shoe and stood up, and there was a German officer with his insignias. I could feel myself go white. Everything came back. The smell of them. I was asked once if I suffered from the stress of it all. I don't know how we did it. You did what you had to do. I lived the way the French people lived. You watched your back all the time. It became second nature.
That was Céline's story. Emily Bett Rickards was the voice of Céline. On the next episode of Invisible Women, Season 1, I'll continue to explore the feminine, but through a different cultural lens. That's coming up on the next episode. Please visit us on the web, where you'll find additional information and resources. And I'd also like to invite you to leave comments or ask any questions you may have, and subscribe to the newsletter. You can do that on the website at www.invisiblewomen.ca. This podcast is produced by Robert Wemet. I'm Diane Gregg. Thanks for listening.